Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
In Lake City, Florida, municipal records, hackers have broken into the city's computers and demanded $460,000 for their return. It's happening all over the country, Atlanta, Baltimore, Dallas, and cities are grappling with whether or not to pay these ransoms. Frances Robles is a correspondent for The New York Times. She's been reporting on this story. She joins us from Key West, Florida. Frances, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So help us understand how widespread these ransom threats are on local governments across the U.S.
Well, it's been going on for years in private companies, hospitals, all kinds of different organizations. What you're starting to see now that's happening more and more is that we're learning about it. And we're learning about it because they're attacking municipal governments. They're attacking ports. They're attacking Department of Transportation in Colorado. And it's the numbers are getting huge and the ransoms are getting huge.
How big?
Oh, $600,000.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it depends on the price of Bitcoin for that day because all of the transactions are in Bitcoin so that it's untraceable. And I think that, it started at $100 and $300, and they realized, well, hey, if it's $300, why not $3,000? If not $3,000, why not $300,000? And so that's kind of where we're at now, where there's this point where the ransomware attackers are thinking, all right, what's the number that I can get where the person doesn't say, all right, forget it, that's too high.
So give us a case in point, Lake City, Florida. In your reporting, you say hackers took control of more than 100 years of Lake City's municipal records. Paint a picture for us. What happened?
Well, so there's a vault in Lake City where all of the documents dating back to before the Civil War, every resolution, the minutes to the meetings, you know, everything, all of those documents had already been scanned page by page. And there was kind of a cool little thing where you can go online and say, you know, Wilson Park, and then see all the records about that. This is the resolution from 1972. This is that. All of that is gone because on Monday, June 10th, when the city officials got to their computers at 7:30 in the morning, there was a little note on their server and it said, how would you like to open this kind of file? It had two email addresses and then it was signed Balance of the Shadow Universe.
Hmm.
So it took them a moment to say, wait a second, Balance of the Shadow Universe, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, I wrote to the email addresses over the weekend just on a whim, like, oh, let's see if they'll answer me. And that's all they answered, a Balance of the Shadow Universe.
You emailed the hackers?
I did. I did it from a separate new email account because I did check with our IT security people first because I was not looking to be the cause of a major crippling breakdown at the New York Times.
And all they replied back was their call name or their
That's
ID.
Correct. Mm. That's right.
All right, back to Lake City, Florida. So what was the impact on the people who live there after this ransom attack?
So for the first few days at City Hall, you know, there's a paralysis, chaos, where the computers don't work, the email doesn't work, the phones didn't have any contacts on them, the copy machines didn't work because they were tied to the network, the printers didn't work because they're tied to the network, the backups were unavailable because that was still on the network. And so, you know, you sense that there was some people's kind of sitting around at their desk thinking, well, should I just go home because there's nothing to do? And so they spend, you know, a few weeks just basically trying to figure out how to work without the regular technology that we've grown so accustomed to. So if you went to pay your water bill, you had to pay in cash and you got a receipt that was written out by hand. One thing that did surprise me is that I did expect more chaos among the residents, you know, people maybe getting their water turned off or things like that. I didn't find too much of that. The chaos seemed to be pretty restricted to City Hall.
So did Lake City pay the hackers' ransom demands?
They did pay. So
they did pay. Okay.
The Florida League of Cities started offering insurance for this about a decade ago. They kind of saw it coming because of it had been hitting private businesses. And so, you know, that's a double-edged sword because, okay, it's great that you have this insurance. And then if you pay, you get a decryption key and you get your records back. But the more that you pay, the more people that are going to get hacked. They wouldn't tell me how much the ransom demand initially was, but whatever it was initially, it was too high. And they were back and forth negotiating. So the negotiation is taking place by the consultants that the Florida League of Cities, the insurer, had hired. So it's not like the city manager is on the phone with, you know, some guy in Iran. And so, you know, back and forth, and a couple of weeks go by. And so they finally decide, okay, 42 Bitcoin, which at that point was about $460,000. And they got the decryption key. But they got the decryption key, I want to say, I'm trying to think now, my mind is slipping, whether it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago at this point, and they don't have everything back.
I was going to say, they haven't recovered all their files.
Yeah, things are decrypted, but that doesn't mean they're in the shape that you want them in. You know, it doesn't mean that cute little searchable database is back online. And so that's the part that is still a work in progress.
We'll talk about the precedent that this all sets for other cities when you actually pay the hackers' ransom demands and what's going on in other big cities across this country. We're discussing hackers attacking local governments. What is the right response? You can join the conversation. Has a ransomware attack hit your town? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're taking a look at the rise of malware attacks on U.S. cities, hospitals, and companies nationwide. And you can join the conversation. Have you lost files, had a hard time paying your utility bill because hackers hit your city? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Here is Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms telling a House Committee on Homeland Security last month that the ransomware attack back in March 2018 in Atlanta left the city, quote, incapacitated.
Some departments and government entities suffered irreparable damage, including our police department, which lost stored dash cam video footage. The Atlanta Municipal Court had to cancel and reschedule hearings. Our customer service interface, known as ATL 311, was knocked offline. Many other applications were impacted or affected, delaying the delivery of city services.
And here is Brett Devich. He's the owner of a title company in Baltimore. He told WMAR2 News in May that during the ransomware attack, his company was unable to record any home purchases or sales.
My heart is beating out of my chest. You know, as a small family business, 16 years in Baltimore City, I don't know what the next 10 minutes will be, let alone the next 3 weeks.
I'm speaking with Frances Robles of the New York Times. She's written about these attacks. And joining me now from Tulsa, Oklahoma, is Tyler Moore, professor of cybersecurity and information assurance at the Tandy School of Computer Science at the University of Tulsa. He's also the director of Stop Badware, a nonprofit and anti-malware organization. You can link to his recent op-ed on ransomware for the Washington Post at our website, onpointradio.org. Tyler, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
So we're just talking about how this wreaks havoc on cities around the country. What makes city governments so vulnerable to malware attacks?
Well, cities are an attractive target for a number of reasons. So first of all, they have lots of data that provides key services to citizens, and citizens have an expectation that they're going to have access to those services and it will be available. And so they become an attractive target that way. The cybersecurity and government systems at all levels of government, but especially at the local level, frequently lags that in the private sector because budgets are tighter, but also because procurement cycles are slower, so it's harder to keep up with the pace of innovation, and the staff pay is unfortunately lower too.
But practically speaking, how do hackers carry out these attacks, these ransomware attacks? How does it happen?
Well, it varies from attack to attack, but essentially there is some way that an attacker can install malware, malicious software, onto a computer system. And at the first stage is often untargeted. They're just trying to get a foothold somewhere. It could be clicking on a link in an email that takes you to a website that will distribute the malicious software. It could be opening an attachment. But once they're in, they will then try to move and see what other computers you're connected to. And in the case of the malware that affected Lake City, it appears that the malware actually tried to see what kind of target they had hit. And only in the event that they found an enterprise that looked like a city did they decide to then go ahead and encrypt the files.
And are these foreign hackers? Who are these people?
We don't know the Florida hackers in this case yet, but we're looking back in history, we know that they typically are. So two Iranians were charged in the ransomware attacks on Atlanta mentioned earlier. There have been other ransomware attacks targeted to citizens in North Korea. So North Korea, Iran, Russia is where a lot of these attackers seem to be.
So the decision of to pay or not to pay, how does that calculation work? I mean, Atlanta refused to pay $51,000 in extortion, and gosh, they've lost millions, right?
Absolutely. So it's a very tough call. I mean, from the perspective of an individual city, you're doing a narrow cost-benefit analysis, the benefits tend to outweigh the cost because the criminals are likely to give you your data back. It might take a while, but you'll get it back. And it's really the only way to do it. And so from that calculation, it's better to do it. But when you take a step back and think at the societal level, it's not so obvious. It's, in fact, paying the ransom has a lot of adverse effects. I mean, it means that this is a viable attack, and so more and more cities are going to be targeted. And like we just said, you end up paying characters in countries that are often under sanction that you wouldn't otherwise want to be providing sources of hard foreign currency.
And Francis Robles, the FBI encourages cities not to pay hackers' extortion demands, but yet some do.
Well, one thing that's really important, I'm not sure the cities that decline to pay, I don't know that it's a moral stance. I think it's a lack of insurance stance. So in Baltimore, we know that they didn't have the insurance. I think that plays a huge factor into it.
Let me get a call in here. Michelle is in Plainfield, Vermont. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the program.
Hello, this is Professor Cadet from Norwich University, and I've been doing information security for 40 years. I want the message to everybody, including individuals, not just cities, make offline backups. That means you back up your information at a frequency that reflects the importance of its being current, and you store the backup medium away from the computer so it cannot be encrypted by ransomware.
Professor, thank you. Tyler Moore, is that possible for cities and towns? Is that actually realistic?
So the advice is to make backups, and he makes a good point in that you can't just stop there because, in fact, Lake City had backups in place, but they were online network backups, and the ransomware spread to there. And so making backups and storing copies of sensitive data offline or on separate networks or using cloud services that will store archival copies for you that cannot be deleted, you have to actually go further than just making backups. You have to actually make a more informed backup decision.
Anna is on the line from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Anna. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I think you all might have just answered my question because my question was, can't they protect themselves by storing their data in the cloud?
In Lake City, they're now going to be paying about $32,000 a year for a cloud service. And the IT director got fired, basically, for not having more of those protections in place.
Does it make a difference, Tyler, where you store, where you back up?
So putting in the cloud can help, but it's the feature that's important is that the cloud service provider needs to store archival copies of backups and not allow you to delete those backup copies. And so if you just have a bog standard cloud service provider, you need to make sure that that feature is enabled.
And Frank from Twitter tells us, test your backups regularly. Know what your recovery process is. Follow the 3-2-1 rule. 3 copies in 2 places, of which 1 is off-site. Tyler Moore, approve?
So I think a lot of this comes down to the need for basic cyber hygiene. And so it's at the point the ransomware is installed, then backups can help you recover. But you also need to have automated patching so that your systems can't be infected in the first place. And so you have a series of failures that enables the ransomware to take hold and then the backups to not be there.
So, Francis Robles, do governments, do hospitals, do private corporations, I mean, what does it take to fend off these attacks? From your reporting, what have you found?
Well, one thing that they're doing now that clearly is a little too late is a lot more training of the employees. So, you know, at the New York Times, I get emails all the time that are spear phishing emails like, hey, take a look at this document, and you're supposed to click on it. And if you click on it, you end up getting a message from our own IT department that says, hey, dummy, you know, you shouldn't open that. Maybe they're a little bit more diplomatic than that. And so you're going to see a much more robust effort to educate everybody. Don't click on every single attachment that you get, even if it looks like it's coming from a source that you trust.
Tyler Moore?
So, yeah, user training is something that people turn to. The research is mixed on that, and shows that it may only be, it's at best partially effective. And so you have to have a robust strategy where maybe you train your employees, but you also have processes in place to try to detect when someone clicks on a link they shouldn't, and try to prevent the malware from spreading, and also, again, investing in a robust backup strategy that's resilient to ransomware.
Francis Robles, you were a correspondent in Colombia in South America, and I'm curious, after seeing, you know, and covering ransom and kidnappings in that part of the world, what can we apply in these situations from what you learned there?
Well, it's interesting that you should mention that, because I brought that up in my interviews in Lake City, and I don't think they liked the analogy. But I told them that when I was based in Colombia, you know, most of the correspondents had at least discussed, and if not put in writing, their personal philosophy on ransom. And so I remember very clearly when a photographer that I worked with, Scott Dalton, and another reporter had been kidnapped. I remember the reporter. I don't remember the photographer. They had already put in writing to their families, if I'm ever kidnapped, don't pay the ransom. Hmm. And the implications of that is very clear. You know, let me rot in the jungle or let them kill me. Because many of us felt that the more that this ransom is paid, you were basically inviting more of your colleagues to spend the next decade in the jungle. And so if you felt really firmly about it, you put that in writing. And so I belong to this really wimpy club of people that felt so firmly about it that I told my family but did not put it in writing because I knew they weren't going to honor it anyway. And so I sort of left a door open that maybe I'll change my mind if I'm ever kidnapped. But it also reminds me of the investigation that the New York Times did about ISIS. And what it showed was that ISIS was being funded by the ransom that the European governments were paying. And so the American government was not paying. So the Americans were being kidnapped at a much lower rate. And those who got kidnapped got murdered. Hmm. You know, so, you know, it's a really tough decision. Are you willing to put, now, obviously, you know, nobody, I don't think the mayor of Lake City was going to be murdered, but you know, that's, you know, you have to, it's a really, right, really big sacrifice, right, that you're making, right, in the sense of for morality of, oh, on principle, I don't believe in paying ransom. Okay, well, then do you believe in paying $17 million like the city of Atlanta is about to have to incur in costs in recovering all your data?
Professor Moore, that's really interesting, right? I mean, jump in here, because in your Washington Post op-ed, you cite instances of ransomware going back to 2006, but they're becoming more and more pervasive. So that decision to pay or not to pay, is that playing into this, to the increase?
Well, I think absolutely. I think that, you know, cyber criminals do what makes them money, at least the profit-motivated one. When they find a playbook that works, they stick to it, and they found that cities seem to be paying. And I think, you know, establishing a norm to not pay is really one of the key long-term countermeasures that we need to be considering. It's very hard to do because every city has their own decision to take. But one thing that's kind of interesting from Francis's reporting is this notion of insurance and the role it plays. And I think one thing we maybe could consider is whether or not insurance should be allowed to pay ransom. In this case, you know, we know that in the case of other instances of cyber insurance with data breaches, for instance, in some states, fines cannot be covered by fines for a breach cannot be covered by the insurance policy. And so the fact that insurance is in premiums are being paid out here could actually making the problem worse than it actually is. And so that could be a coordinated way in which we might take the air out of some of these ransom amounts.
By the way, we asked the FBI to join us today. They declined, but they sent this statement, which reads, "The FBI encourages victims not to pay a hacker's extortion demands. The payment of extortion demands encourages continued criminal activity, leads to other victimizations, and can be used to facilitate additional serious crimes. Additionally, paying a ransom does not guarantee the victim will regain access to their data. The best approach is to focus on defense in depth and have several layers of security, as there is no single method to prevent compromise or exploitation." So, Professor Moore, just a couple of minutes left here. Is there any action on the federal level to address these concerns, these ransomware attacks, and what these cities and municipalities are dealing with?
Well, some things are quite encouraging. So, in the sense that two Iranians behind the Atlanta attacks were charged, right? And so I think one of the things that's sort of underappreciated in the fight against cybercrime generally, not just for ransomware, is that law enforcement has a very significant role to play, and I don't think we're investing enough in fighting cybercrime at that level, because many cybercriminals feel quite rationally that they can act with impunity. They can carry out these ransoms and get away with it most of the time. And so if we can actually make that more difficult and root out some of the crime there, then that will deflect criminal activities towards other areas. And so I think that's one of the key areas in which we can make a real difference, is really putting more emphasis on beefing up our anti-cybercrime capabilities.
How do you see it, Francis Robles?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that there's only one solution here, and that we have to protect ourselves. You know, you don't protect, you know, your house. If you don't want burglars to come in, you don't just get really good, you know, renter's insurance. You put a lock on the door.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for your information, for your time, for helping us understand this vexing problem for a lot of cities and towns across the country that are losing millions and millions of dollars. Francis Robles, correspondent for The New York Times. You can link to her recent piece headlined, "A City Paid a Hefty Ransom to Hackers, But the Pains Are Far From Over." That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Francis, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Jane.
And Tyler Moore, professor of cybersecurity and information assurance at the University of Tulsa. He's also director of Stop Badware, a nonprofit anti-malware organization. You can link to his recent op-ed on ransomware for The Washington Post. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Tyler Moore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justin Daum, Alina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.